Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do chapters 5 and 6 from Hector Humanroe, or Saki's novel, The Unbearable Bassington. Let's get to it. Chapter 5. On a conveniently secluded bench facing the northern pheasantry in the Zoological Society's gardens, Regent's Park, Courtney Ugel sat immersed in mature flirtation with a lady who, though certainly young in fact and appearance, was some 4 or 5 years his senior. When he was a schoolboy of 16, Molly McQuaid had personally conducted him to the zoo and stood him dinner afterwards at Kettner's, and whenever the two of them happened to be in town on the anniversary of that bygone festivity, they religiously repeated the program in its entirety. Even the menu of the dinner was adhered to as nearly as possible, the original selection of food and wine that schoolboy exuberance, tempered by schoolboy shyness, had pitched on those many years ago. They say that a lot, that pitched on, landed on, chose, selected. Pitched on those many years ago, confronted Ugel on those occasions, as a drowning man's past life is said to rise up and parade itself in his last moment of consciousness. The flirtation, which was thus perennially restored to its old-time footing, owed its longevity more to the enterprising solicitude of Miss McQuaid than to any conscious sentimental effort on the part of Ugel himself. Molly McQuaid was known to her neighbors in a minor hunting shire as a hard-riding, conventionally unconventional type of young woman who came naturally into the classification a good sort. She was just sufficiently good-looking, sufficiently reticent about her own illnesses when she had any, and sufficiently appreciative of her neighbors' gardens, children, and hunters to be generally popular. Most men liked her, and the percentage of women who disliked her was not inconveniently high. One of these days, it was assumed, she would marry a brewer or master of otter hounds, and after a brief interval, be known to the world as the mother of a boy or two at Malvern or some similar seat of learning. The romantic side of her nature was altogether unguessed by the countryside. Her romances were mostly in serial form and suffered perhaps in fervor from their disconnected course what they gained in length of days. Her affectionate interest in the several young men who figured in her affairs of the heart was perfectly honest and certainly made no attempt either to conceal their separate existences or to play them off against one another. Neither could it be said that she was a husband hunter. She had made up her mind what sort of a man she was likely to marry, and her forecast did not differ very widely from that formed by her local acquaintances. If her married life were eventually to turn out a failure, at least she looked forward to it with a very moderate expectations. Her love affairs she put on a very different footing, and apparently they were the all-absorbing element in her life. She possessed the happily constituted temperament which enables a man or woman to be a pluralist, and to observe the sage precaution of not putting all one's eggs into one basket. Her demands were not exacting. She required of her affinity that he should be young, good-looking, and at least moderately amusing. She would have preferred him to be invariably faithful, but with her own example before her, she was prepared for the probability, bordering on certainty, that he would be nothing of the sort. The philosophy of the Garden of Kama, was the compass by which she steered her bark. A bark is a type of ship, and thus far, if she had encountered some storms and buffetings, she had at least escaped being either shipwrecked or becalmed. Becalmed when you can't move if you've got a sailboat and there's no wind. Garden of Kama, I do not know what it means, and I doubt I'll be able to find it if I look it up. Perhaps wrongly. Courtney Ugel had not been designed by nature to fulfill the role of an ardent or devoted lover, and he scrupulously, again, that word didn't mean physical so much back then, and he scrupulously respected the limits which nature had laid down. For Molly, however, he had a certain responsive affection. She had always obviously admired him, and at the same time, she never beset him with crude flattery. The principal reason why the flirtation had stood the test of so many years and was the fact that it only flared into active existence at convenient intervals. In an age when the telephone has undermined almost every fastness of human privacy, note the use of fastness, and the sanctity of one's seclusion depends often on the ability for tactful falsehood shown by a club page boy, i.e. saying you're not here, Yugel was duly appreciative of the circumstance that his lady fair spent a large part of the year pursuing foxes in lieu of pursuing him. Also, the honestly admitted fact that, in her human hunting, she rode after more than one quarry, made the inevitable breakup of the affair a matter to which both could look forward without a sense of coming embarrassment and recrimination. When the time for gathering ye rosebud should be over, neither of them could accuse the other of having wrecked his or her entire life. At the most, they would have only disorganized a weekend. On this particular afternoon, when old reminiscences had been gone through and the intervening gossip of past months duly recounted, a lull in the conversation made itself rather obstinately felt. Molly had already guessed that matters were about to slip into a new phase. The affair had reached maturity long ago, and a new phase must be in the nature of a wane. "You're a clever brute," she said suddenly, with an air of affectionate regret. "I always knew you'd get on in the house, but I hardly expected you'd come to the front so soon." "I'm coming to the front," admitted Yugel judicially. "The problem is, shall I be able to stay there? Unless something happens in the financial line before long, I don't see how I'm to stay in Parliament at all. Economy is out of the question. It would open people's eyes, I fancy, if they knew how little I exist on as it is. And I'm living so far beyond my income that we may be almost said to be living apart." Tempting a wild-like witticism. "I'm living so far beyond my income that we may almost be said to be living apart. Remember, this is the fellow who may be a competitor with Comus for the affections of the young woman at the dinner party, a different one from the one here. And remember, the young woman at the dinner party, who I forget her name, but she is quite rich. And that's what he needs, this Courtney Yugel." "It will have to be a rich wife, I suppose," said Molly slowly. "That's the worst of success. It imposes so many conditions. I rather knew from something in your manner that you were drifting away." Pardon me, that was drifting that way. Yugel said nothing in way of contradiction. He gazed steadfastly at the aviary in front of him as though exotic pheasants were for the moment the most absorbing study in the world. As a matter of fact, his mind was centered on the image of Elaine de Frey, that's the young woman at the dinner, with her clear, untroubled eyes and her Leonardo da Vinci air. He was wondering whether he was likely to fall into a frame of mind concerning her, which should be in the least like falling in love. "I shall mind horribly," continued Molly after a pause, "but of course I've always known that something of the sort would have to happen one of these days. When a man goes into politics, he can't call his soul his own, and I suppose his heart becomes an impersonal possession in the same way." "Most people who know me would tell you that I haven't got a heart," said Yugel. "I've often felt inclined to agree with them," said Molly, "and then, now and again, I think you have a heart tucked away somewhere." "I hope I am," said Yugel, "because I'm trying to break to you the fact that I think I'm falling in love with somebody." Molly McQuaid turned sharply to look at her companion, who still fixed his gaze on the pheasant run in front of him. "Don't tell me you're losing your head over somebody useless, someone without money," she said. "I don't think I could stand that." For the moment, she feared that Courtney's selfishness might have taken an unexpected turn, in which ambition had given way to the fancy of the hour. He might be going to sacrifice his parliamentary career for a life of stupid lounging in momentarily attractive company. He quickly undeceived her. "She's got heaps of money." Molly gave a grunt of relief. Her affection for Courtney had produced the anxiety which underlay her first question. A natural jealousy prompted the next one. Young and quite good-looking in her way, and a distinct style of her own. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed the paragraph. Is she young and pretty and all that sort of thing, or is she just a good sort with a sympathetic manner and nice eyes? As a rule, that's the kind that goes with a lot of money. Young and quite good-looking in her way, a distinct style of her own. Some people would call her beautiful. As a political hostess, I should think she'd be splendid. I imagine I'm rather in love with her. And is she in love with you? Ugel threw back his head with a slight assertive movement that Molly knew and liked. She's a girl who I fancy would let judgment influence her a lot, and without being stupidly conceited, I think I may say that she might do worse than throw herself away on me. I'm young and quite good-looking, and I'm making a name for myself in the house. She'll be able to read all sorts of nice and horrid things about me in the papers at breakfast time. I can be brilliantly amusing at times, and I understand the value of silence. There is no fear that I shall ever degenerate into that fearsome thing, a cheerful, talkative husband. For a girl with money and social ambitions, I should think I was rather a good thing. Maybe I should have said, I should think I was rather a good thing. You are certainly in love, Courtney, said Molly, but it's the old love and not a new one. I'm rather glad. I should have hated to have you head over heels in love with a pretty woman, even for a short time. You'll be much happier as it is. And I'm going to put all my feelings in the background and tell you to go in and win. You've got to marry a rich woman, and if she's nice and will make a good hostess, so much the better for everybody. You'll be happier in your married life than I shall be in mine when it comes. You'll have other interests to absorb you. I shall just have the garden and dairy and nursery and lending library. As like as two peas to all the gardens and dairies and nurseries for hundreds of miles round. You won't care for your wife enough to be worried every time she has a finger ache, and you'll like her well enough to be pleased to meet her sometimes at your own house. I shouldn't wonder if you are quite happy. She will probably be miserable, but any woman who married you would be. There was a short pause. They were both staring at the pheasant cages. Then Molly spoke again with the swift, nervous tone of a general who is hurriedly altering the disposition of his forces for a strategic retreat. When you are safely married and honeymooned and all that sort of thing, and have put your wife through her paces as a political hostess sometime, when the house isn't sitting, you must come down by yourself and do a little hunting with us. Will you? It won't be quite the same as old times, but it will be something to look forward to when I'm reading the endless paragraphs about your fashionable political wedding. You're looking forward pretty far, laughed Ugel. The lady may take your view as to the probable unhappiness of a future shared with me, and I may have to content myself with penurious political bachelorhood. Anyhow, the present is still with us. We dine at Kettner's tonight, don't we? Rather, said Molly, though it will be more or less a throat-lumpy feast, as far as I am concerned. We shall have to drink to the health of the future Mrs. Ugel. By the way, it's rather characteristic of you that you haven't told me who she is, and of me that I haven't asked. And now, like a dear boy, trot away and leave me. I haven't got to say goodbye to you yet, but I'm going to take a quiet farewell of the pheasant tree. We've had some jolly good talks, you and I, sitting in this seat, haven't we? And I know as well as I know anything that this is the last of them. 8 o'clock tonight, as punctually as possible. She watched his retreating figure with eyes that grew slowly misty. He had been such a jolly, comely boyfriend, comely attractive, and they had such good times together. The mist deepened on her lashes as she looked round at the familiar rendezvous where they had so often kept tryst since the day when they had first come there together, he a schoolboy and she but lately out of her teens. For the moment, she felt herself in the thrall of a very real sorrow. Then, with the admirable energy of one who is only in town for a fleeting fortnight, she raced away to have tea with a world-faring naval admirer at his club. Pluralism is a merciful narcotic. As they might say nowadays, spinning plates or some such. That's the end of chapter 5. Chapter 6. Elaine de Frey, the lady in question, sat at ease, the one that Comus and Courtenay both want. Elaine de Frey sat at ease, at bodily ease at any rate, in a low wicker chair placed under the shade of a group of cedars in the heart of a stately, spacious garden that had almost made up its mind to be a park. The shallow stone basin of an old fountain, on whose wide ledge a leaden-molded otter forever preyed on a leaden salmon, filled a conspicuous place in the immediate foreground. Around its rim ran an inscription in Latin, warning mortal man that time flows as swiftly as water, and exhorting him to make the most of the hours, after which piece of Jacobean... After which piece of Jacobean moralizing, it set itself shamelessly to beguile all who might pass that way into an abandonment of contemplative repose. Don't waste your time sitting here in this nice place. On all sides of it, a stretch of smooth turf spread away, broken up here and there by groups of dwarfish chestnut and mulberry trees, whose leaves and branches cast a laced pattern of shade beneath them. On one side, the lawn sloped gently down to a small lake, whereon floated a quartet of swans, their movements suggestive of a certain mournful listlessness, as though weary dignity of caste held them back from the joyous, bustling life of the lesser waterfowl. Elaine liked to imagine that they re-embodied the souls of unhappy boys who had been forced by family interest to become high ecclesiastical dignitaries and had grown prematurely right reverend. A low stone balustrade fenced part of the shore of the lake, making a miniature terrace above its level, and here roses grew in a rich multitude. Other rose bushes, carefully pruned and tended, formed little oases of color and perfume amid the restful green of the sward, and in the distance the eye caught the variegated blaze of a many-hued hedge of rhododendron. With these favored exceptions, flowers were hard to find in this well-ordered garden. The misguided tyranny of staring geranium beds and beflowered archways leading to nowhere, so dear to the suburban gardener, found no expression here. Magnificent Amherst pheasants, whose plumage challenged and almost shamed the peacock on his own ground, stepped to and fro over the emerald turf with the assured self-conscious pride of reigning sultans. It was a garden where summer seemed a part proprietor rather than a hurried visitor. By the side of Elaine's chair, under the shadow of the cedars, a wicker table was set out with a paraphernalia of afternoon tea. On some cushions at her feet reclined Courtenay Ugel, smoothly preened and youthfully elegant, the personification of decorative repose. Equally decorative, but with the showy restlessness of a dragonfly, Comus disported his flanneled person over a considerable span of the available foreground. And remember, Comus is being mentored, I think you could call it, by Courtenay. So they're not only after the same woman, but they have their own private relationship. The intimacy existing between the two young men had suffered no immediate dislocation from the circumstance that they were tacitly paying court to the same lady. It was an intimacy founded not in the least on friendship or community of tastes and interests, but owed its existence to the fact that each was amused and interested by the other. Ugel found Comus, for the time being at any rate, just as amusing and interesting as a rival for Elaine's favor as he had been in the role of scapegrace boy about town. Comus, for his part, did not wish to lose touch with Ugel, who, among other attractions, possessed the recommendation of being under the ban of Comus's mother. She disapproved, it is true, of a great many of her son's friends and associates, but this particular one was a special and persistent source of irritation to her from the fact that he figured prominently and more or less successfully in the public life of the day. There was something peculiarly exasperating in reading a brilliant and incisive attack on the government's rash handling of public expenditure delivered by a young man who encouraged her son in every imaginable extravagance. So he likes Courtney because he pisses off his mom. And he's something of a hypocrite. The actual extent of Hugo's influence over the boy was of the slightest. So his mom is wrong thinking this guy is an influence. He's just, in some ways, a similar type. Comus was quite capable of deriving encouragement to rash outlay and frivolous conversation from an anchorite or an East End person if he had been thrown into close companionship with such an individual. Now, an anchorite is a hermit or someone who lives alone in the fastness or in the wilderness. It's a biblical term, anchorite, sort of a synonym for hermit. And an East End person, East End parson. Now, that I don't know what that means because I associate the East End of London with a bunch of Jews, but I don't think that's what he's referring to here. And so an East End parson, I don't know why that would be a person who would encourage extravagance. Francesca, however, exercised a mother's privilege in assuming her son's bachelor associates to be industrious and laboring to achieve his undoing. That's typical of women. My boy is the good one. My boy wouldn't ever do something like that. They all think like that. Grandmothers think like that, too. They always think someone else led him astray. But only rarely is it so. He either had a hand in it himself or led the thing himself, and they just can't accept it. All sons are didn't-do-nothings to mothers, even if they're white. There's a good degree of truth in that. Therefore, the young politician was a source of unconcealed annoyance to her, and in the same degree she expressed her disapproval of him, Comus was careful to maintain and parade the intimacy. So he's continually twitting her, just for fun. Its existence, or rather its continued existence, was one of the things that faintly puzzled the young lady, whose sought-for favor might have been expected to furnish an occasion for its rapid dissolution. With two suitors, one of whom at least she found markedly attractive, courting her at the same moment, Elaine should have had reasonable cause for being on good terms with the world and with herself in particular. Happiness was not, however, at this auspicious moment, her dominant mood. The grave calm of her face masked as usual a certain degree of grave perturbation. A succession of well-meaning governesses and a plentiful supply of moralizing aunts on both sides of the family had impressed on her young mind the theoretical fact that wealth is a great responsibility. The consciousness of her responsibility, tell my junior high school professor, who kind of moved weirdly because he had polio. Responsibility was his big word. The consciousness of her responsibility set her continually wondering, not as to her own fitness to discharge her stewardship, but as to the motives and merits of people with whom she came in contact. The knowledge that there was so much in the world that she could buy invited speculation as to how much there was that was worth buying. Gradually, she had come to regard her mind as a sort of appeal court before whose secret sittings were examined and judged the motives and actions, the motives especially of the world in general. In her schoolroom days, she had sat in conscientious judgment on the motives that guided or misguided Charles and Cromwell and Monk, Wallenstein, and Savonarola. In her present stage, she was equally occupied in examining the political sincerity of the Secretary for Foreign Affairs, the good faith of a honey-tongued but possibly loyal-hearted waiting maid, and the disinterestedness of a whole circle of indulgent and flattering acquaintances. So she's already learned the lesson they're after you for your money. Even more absorbing, and in her eyes, more urgently necessary, was the task of dissecting and appraising the characters of the two young men who were favoring her with their attentions. And herein lay cause for much thinking and some perturbation. Hugel, for example, might have baffled a more experienced observer of human nature. Elaine Defry was too clever to confound his dandyism with foppishness or self-advertisement. He admired his own toilet effect in a mirror from a genuine sense of pleasure in a thing good to look upon, just as he would feel a sensuous appreciation of the sight of a well-bred, well-matched, well-turned-out pair of horses. Behind his careful political flippancy and cynicism, one might also detect a certain careless sincerity, which would probably in the long run save him from moderate success and turn him into one of the brilliant failures of the day, because he actually is after something. He's not just cynical money shifter. And here again, Anglo politics, and this is what we have, and we are where we are because of this attitude. Contrast with Hitler. He was not in it for money, but these English are in it for money. But she's saying this particular guy is not as cynical as he should be. He's witty and cynical and well turned out for show because he appreciates that, but there really is a real sincerity underneath, or more than will do him good in a political life, she's saying. Beyond that, it was difficult to form an exact appreciation of Courtenay, Ugel, and Elaine, who liked to have her impressions distinctly labeled and pigeonholed, was perpetually scrutinizing the outer surface of his characteristics and utterances like a baffled art critic vainly searching beneath the varnish and scratches of a doubtfully assigned picture for an enlightening signature. So see, think about our culture today. You meet someone, you like them, you fuck them. Not to be too crude or blunt, but in the old days before they did that, they would take literally months, not months, but literally years getting to know each other, sussing each other out, considering the possible marriage alliance from every possible point of view, and really knowing the character of who they were dealing with before they ever so much as dared to take their first item of clothing off. That's a higher culture than what we have now. The young man added to her perplexities by his deliberate policy of, again, he's young, like Comus is young, but so is Courtenay, by his deliberate policy of never trying to show himself in a favorable light, even when most anxious to impart a favorable impression. He preferred that people should hunt for his good qualities and merely took very good care that, as far as possible, they should never draw blank. So he's actually trying to be, not just to seem, which is admirable. And also that's an advanced and superior way. The average person, the low person, naturally tries to boost themselves with praise and endless positive adjectives. But the smarter person trusts that you can make out what they are. They trust, as I always say, particularly for two women, but it goes for everyone. Women think you can just say, I am this, I am that, I am funny, I am intelligent. You can't do it like that. If you are those things, you have to trust that people will pick it up. So trust your own material is the way I always put it. And that goes for men and everything else. If you have something, people will see it. And if you don't have it, you can't get it by claiming it. Now, so this guy's going about it the right way. He's not trying to impress her. He realizes she's fairly intelligent. She's going to be able to see me for what I am and make sure that when she actually looks within, there's something there. And that goes for the world in general, too. So he doesn't just look good. He's not a fop if he is a dandy. He actually has some virtues. We already saw how he outwitted Comus's mother. He preferred that people should hunt for his good qualities and merely took very good care that, as far as possible, they should never draw blank. See, again, from literature, you learn psychology, you learn what better people think, and you learn how to act if you don't have an instinctive appreciation of it. Let them, when they look for your good qualities, find them. Even in the matter of selfishness, which was the anchor sheet of his existence, he contrived to be noted, and justly noted, for doing remarkably unselfish things. As a ruler, he would have been reasonably popular. As a husband, he would probably be unendurable. And that's a remark of your woman. You can think of that. Why would this type of person be unendurable? It doesn't sound unendurable. But if she also likes Comus, or is at least entertaining his attentions, then you have the impression that she wants more of a bad boy, even in marriage, than she wants someone who's knows what he's about and knows how to cover his bad points and even make them look good, I think is what that means. Comus was, to a certain extent, as great a mystification as Yugel, but here Elaine was herself responsible for some of the perplexity which enshrouded his character in her eyes. She had taken more than a passing fancy for the boy, as he might be, that was to say, and she was desperately unwilling to see him and appraise him as he really was. So she wants to see him the way she wants him to be in her imagination, rather than what he might be, kind of a trifling, unserious type. She wants to invest him with virtues because she likes him. She was desperately unwilling to see him and appraise him as he really was. Very interesting. So he clearly has his hooks in her without even trying. Thus, the mental court of appeal was constantly engaged in examining witnesses as to character, most of whom signally failed to give any testimony which would support the favorable judgment which the tribunal was so anxious to arrive at. A woman with wider experience of the world's ways and shortcomings would probably have contented herself with an endeavor to find out whether her liking for the boy outweighed her dislike of his characteristics. Elaine took her judgments too seriously to approach the matter from such a simple and convenient standpoint. The fact that she was much more than half in love with Comus made it dreadfully important that she should discover him to have a lovable soul, and Comus, it must be confessed, did little to help forward the discovery. At any rate, he is honest, and you know, young women are going to like bad boys until they basically grow up and realize what the deal is, and then they'll still like him, but they'll tend to go for someone who's more stable, if less thrilling. That's the way of the world, generally. At any rate, he is honest, she would observe to herself after some outspoken admission of the principled conduct of unprincipled conduct on his part. And then she would ruefully recall certain episodes in which he had figured, from which honesty had been conspicuously absent. When she tried to label honesty in his candor, what she tried to label honesty in his candor was probably only a cynical defiance of the laws of right and wrong. "You look more than unusually thoughtful this afternoon," said Comus to her, "as if you had invented this summer day and were trying to think up improvements, think out improvements." "If I had the power to create improvements anywhere, I think I should begin with you," retorted Elaine. "I'm sure it's much better to leave me as I am," protested Comus. "You're like a relative of mine up in Argyllshire who spends his time producing improved breeds of sheep and pigs and chickens. So patronizing and irritating to the Almighty, I should think, to go about putting superior finishing touches to creation." Like my teacher used to say, there's Rachel, whenever he'd see a girl combing hair, "There's Rachel trying to do what God himself could, make her any better looking." I mean, you got to amuse yourself saying stuff like that to keep your sanity as a high school teacher, I'm quite sure. Anyway, let's see. And, you know, that's a handful of things like that is literally all I remember of high school. I always looked at things from a sort of aesthetic point of view. Things that were funny to me, I would collect in my mind. The rest I didn't really like. And I don't think most people really like school. Why would they? Elaine frowned and then laughed and finally gave a little sigh. "It's not easy to talk sense to you," she said. "Whatever else you take in hand," said Yugel, "you must never improve this garden. It's what our idea of heaven might be like if Jews hadn't invented one for us on totally different lines." Well, that's an interesting thing to say. He's saying this is like the white idea of heaven. This garden, peacocks running about. "It's dreadful that we should accept them as the impresarios of our religious dreamland instead of the Greeks." How about that? There you have, you know, frank admission. They've supplied our spiritual life, and their national history is our religion. That is absolutely insane. And their history isn't even real history. "You're not very fond of the Jews," said Elaine. "I've traveled and lived a good deal in Eastern Europe," said Yugel. It seems largely a question of geography, said Elaine. In England, no one really is anti-Semitic. Yugel shook his head. I know a great many Jews who are. Servants had quietly, almost reverently, placed tea and its accessories on the wicker table. Even back then, anti-Semitic was a scam that was widely spread by the Jews owning the media. Servants had quietly, almost reverently, placed tea and its accessories on the wicker table and quietly receded from the landscape. Elaine sat like a grave young goddess about to dispense some mysterious potion to her devotees. Her mind was still sitting in judgment on the Jewish question. Comus scrambled to his feet. It's too hot for tea, and remember, so the East End remark we had before, so the Jews had come in large numbers to the East End of London, and these are dirty, nasty, Galician, Polish, Russian-type Jews that are really scummy and dishonest, among whom was found Jack the Ripper and other notables. Comus scrambled to his feet. It's too hot for tea, he said. I shall go and feed the swans. And he walked off with the little silver basket dish containing the brown bread and butter. Elaine laughed quietly. It's so like Comus, she said, to go off with our one dish of bread and butter. Yugel chuckled responsively. It was an undoubted opportunity for him to put in some disparaging criticism of Comus, and Elaine sat alert in readiness to judge the critic and reserve judgment on the criticized. His selfishness is splendid, but absolutely futile, said Yugel. Now, my selfishness is commonplace, but always thoroughly practical and calculated. He will have great difficulty in getting the swans to accept his offering, and he incurs the odium of having reduced us to a bread and butterless condition. Incidentally, he will get very hot. Elaine again had the sense of being thoroughly baffled. If Yugel had said anything unkind, it was about himself. If my cousin Suzette had been here, she observed, with the shadow of a malicious smile on her lips, I believe she would have gone into a flood of tears at the loss of her bread and butter, and Comus would have figured ever after in her mind as something black and destroying and hateful. In fact, I don't really know why we took our loss so unprotestingly. For two reasons, said Yugel. You are rather fond of Comus, and I am not very fond of bread and butter. The jesting remark brought a throb of pleasure to Elaine's heart. She had known full well that she cared for Comus, but now that Courtney Yugel had openly proclaimed the fact as something unchallenged and understood, matters seemed placed at once in a more advanced footing. So they all know what's going on there. The warm, sunlit garden grew suddenly into a heaven that held the secret of eternal happiness. Youth and comeliness would always walk here, under the low-boughed mulberry trees, as unchanging as the leaden otter that forever preyed on the leaden salmon on the edge of the old fountain. And somehow the lovers would always wear the aspect of herself and the boy who was talking to the four white swans by the water steps. Yugel was right. This was the real heaven of one's dreams and longings, immeasurably removed from that Rue de la Paix paradise about which one professed utterly insincere hankerings in places of public worship. Elaine drank her tea in happy silence. Besides being a brilliant talker, Yugel understood the rarer art of being a non-talker on occasion. He knew when to shut up. Comus came back across the grass, swinging the empty basket dish in his hand. Swans were very pleased, he cried gaily, and said they hoped I would keep the bread and butter dish as a souvenir of a happy tea party. I may really have it, mayn't I? He continued in an anxious voice. It will do, keeping studs and things in it. You don't want it. It's got the family crest on it, said Elaine. Some of the happiness had died out of her eyes. I'll have that scratched off and my own put on, said Comus. It's been in the family for generations, protested Elaine, who did not share Comus's view that because you were rich, your lesser possessions could have no value in your eyes. I want it dreadfully, said Comus sulkily, and you've heaps of other things to put bread and butter in. For the moment, he was possessed by an overmastering desire to keep the dish at all costs. A look of greedy determination dominated his face, and he had not for an instant relaxed his grip of the coveted object. Elaine was genuinely angry by this time and was busily telling herself that it was absurd to be put over, to be put out over such a trifle. Semicolon, as he always uses. At the same moment, a sense of justice was telling her that Comus was displaying a good deal of rather shabby selfishness. And somehow, her chief anxiety at the moment was to keep Courtney Ugel from seeing that she was angry. "I know you don't really want it, so I'm going to keep it," persisted Comus. "It's too hot to argue," said Elaine. "Happy mistress of your destinies," laughed Ugel. "You can suit your disputations to the desired time and temperature. I have to go and argue, or what is worse, listen to other people's arguments in a hot and doctored atmosphere suitable to an invalid lizard." Again, probably before air conditioning was invented. "You haven't got to argue about a bread and butter dish," said Elaine. "Chiefly about bread and butter," said Ugel. "Our great preoccupation is other people's bread and butter. They earn or produce the material, but we busy ourselves with making rules how it shall be cut up and the size of the slices and how much butter shall go on how much bread. That is what is called legislation. If we could only make rules as to how the bread and butter should be digested, we should be quite happy." Elaine had been brought up to regard parliaments as something to be treated with cheerful solemnity, like illness or family reunions. Ugel's flippant disparagement of the career in which he was involved did not, however, jar on her susceptibilities. She knew him to be only a lively and effective debater, but an industrious worker on committees. If he made light of his labors, or at least he afforded no one else a loophole for doing so. And certainly the parliamentary atmosphere was not uninviting on this hot afternoon. "When must you go?" she asked sympathetically. Ugel looked ruefully at his watch. Before he could answer, a cheerful hoot came through the air, as of an owl joyously challenging the sunlight with a foreboding of the coming night. He sprang laughing to his feet. "Listen, my summons back to my galley," he cried. "The gods have given me an hour in this enchanted garden, so I must not complain." Then, in the lower voice, he almost whispered, "It's the Persian debate tonight." It was the one hint he had given in the midst of his talking and laughing that he was really keenly enthralled in the work that lay before him. It was the one little intimate touch that gave Elaine the knowledge that he cared for her opinion of his work. Comus, who had emptied his cigarette case, became suddenly clamorous at the prospect of being temporarily stranded without a smoke. Ugel took the last remaining cigarette from his own case and gravely bisected it. "Friendship could go no further," he observed, as he gave one half to the doubtfully appeased Comus and lit the other half himself. "There are heaps more in the hall," said Elaine. "It was only done for the St. Martin of Tours effect," said Ugel. "I hate smoking when I'm rushing through the air. Goodbye." The departing galley slave stepped forth into the sunlight, radiant and confident. A few minutes later, Elaine could see glimpses of his white car as it rushed past the rhododendron bushes. He woos best who leaves first, particularly if he goes forth to battle or the semblance of battle. Somehow Elaine's garden of eternal youth had already become clouded in its imagery. The girl figure who walked in it was still distinctly and unchangingly its herself, but her companion was more blurred and undefined as a picture that has been superimposed on another. Ugel sped townward, well satisfied with himself. Tomorrow, he reflected, Elaine would read his speech in her morning paper, and he knew in advance that it was not going to be one of his worst efforts. He knew almost exactly where the punctuations of laughter and applause would burst in. He knew that nimble fingers in the press gallery would be taking down each jibe and argument as he flung it at the impassive minister confronting him, and that the fair lady of his desire would be able to judge what manner of young man this was who spent his afternoon in her garden lazily chaffing himself and his world. He's just criticizing, chaffing. And he further reflected with an amused chuckle that she would be vividly reminded of Comus for days to come when she took her afternoon tea and saw the bread and butter reposing in an unaccustomed dish. And we'll leave it right there, just shy of 45 minutes. So Courtney Ugel is thinking he's got the upper hand as a result of today's actions. But anyway, Elaine DeFry has a difficult choice to make. So I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Saki. This was chapters 4 and 5 of The Unbearable Bassington. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.